So there's kind of controls and oversight you could put in place. But, and this is a big theme of what we're talking about today, it'll never be enough, let's be honest, right? And it always has to go hand in hand with this awareness of our employees. And you gotta make sure that you have folks that says, that's a little weird, like that guy never leaves me a voicemail, right? And you kind of gotta get that instinct up.
From McKinsey & Company, I'm Sean Brown, and welcome to Inside the Strategy Room. You just heard Ida Christensen sharing a sneak preview of the challenge we'll be tackling today, how to manage the risks inherent in Gen AI. We'll base our conversation partly on insights from our recent article titled Implementing Generative AI with Speed and Safety, which you can find on McKinsey.com. It's a big topic with many angles, and we encourage you to check out the article. We've also included a link to the article in the show notes. And now, let me introduce our guests. Ida is a senior partner in our New York office and the global co-leader of our risk and resilience practice. She serves clients on strategy, cybersecurity, and risk management topics. Ida, it is great to have you here today. Thanks for joining.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back with you, Sean.
Also joining us is Oliver Bevan, a partner in our Chicago office and a leader in our risk and resilience and technology practices. Oliver leads our client work at the intersection of technology and risk with a focus on generative AI, data privacy, third-party management, and trust and safety. Oliver, welcome.
Thank you, Sean. Really excited for this discussion.
And I am as well. Given how recently Gen AI has come on the scene, it's amazing how much evolution we've already seen. And with all new technologies, and particularly with one this powerful, there are also many risks. Ida, are you finding your clients widely embracing Gen AI, or are they taking a more skeptical wait-and-see approach?
We see the early adopters that are incredibly excited. We also see a bunch of folks who are quite skeptical and say, maybe we'll wait this one out. And so showing our cards, you know, we are very much in the camp of saying Gen AI is here to stay. It offers incredible strategic opportunities across industries, across aspects of the things that each business does. And we really truly believe that there is a path here to extract amazing benefits. Secondly, we also believe that the idea of waiting this one out is not feasible. This is becoming a strategic imperative. And given that we are talking about this from a risk angle, another way to say the same thing, there's substantial strategic risk associated with not diving in. But thirdly, there's some real risks associated with this. And we really believe for organizations to be successful, it requires a defensive as well as offensive strategy. What does it mean to set up the right control structures around this? And how do you think about the duality of both the risks you're facing as an organization just because Gen AI exists in the world and the tools that third parties can use have now evolved dramatically, as well as the Gen AI risk that an organization will take on by exploring use cases and using different kind of technology with Gen AI features embedded in it. And you really need to think about the inbound risk, if you will, and the risk that an organization's create.
Thank you, Ida. So Oliver, what are some of the regulatory dynamics that companies that are exploring Gen AI need to be particularly mindful of?
I'm going to just emphasize a lot of what Ida's just said, which is, I think it's really important to note just how different jurisdictions are taking different approaches to thinking about the risks of generative AI and how they want to govern and approach the overall management of them. This, I think, is importantly different from what we saw from the early days of data privacy. And I think in data privacy, there was a sense that GDPR really led the way. A lot of our clients had adapted their initial data privacy framework to GDPR and then used that to extend beyond that and think about how could they adapt the global framework on the base of GDPR. We saw a lot of legislation that followed in the steps of GDPR, including how Brazil thought about it. Some of what was happening in California drew directly on GDPR as well. Our sense is that's going to be much trickier to do with generative AI. I think given what Ida said about strategic imperative, it's also clear to a lot of the public sector how much value is at stake and how much it can directly impact citizens. Obviously, that the risks are across data privacy, cybersecurity concerns around deepfakes, which can have significant impact on elections and other public-facing events. And so that's why a lot of the public actors have taken much more of a front-foot approach to thinking about the dynamics of generative AI and therefore the responses that organizations need to have, especially if you're operating across multiple jurisdictions, how you think about regulatory change, and how you're going to adapt and embed that into your approaches is going to be incredibly important here.
Thanks, Oliver. And for listeners who may not be familiar with the term, GDPR stands for General Data Protection Regulation, and it's the European Union's longstanding regulations on information privacy. Now, how do the risks and the regulatory landscape differ between Gen AI and some of the other advances in AI, including machine learning?
It's a fantastic question. I think my perspective is the analytical AI, so the AI development machine learning prior to the adoption of generative AI was basically anchored in two primary places. One is data privacy, so considerations around how are these models using data? How are you combining data to do synthetic analysis or increase the potential for outputs? And then the second one was really on questions around fairness in the model structures. So I think we're all aware, unfortunately, these models tend to have very different outcomes depending on whether you are looking of different skin tones, different genders, even on the analytical AI. That triggered a lot of concerns, especially in the US, around fair housing legislation and how do you think about optimizing that credit score analysis in the financial services sector. And so those, in my interpretation, were the two foundations of what's happening. Those are still very important for generative AI, but there's also now an increasing awareness of the challenges that come from explainability, for example. Obviously, the potential for deepfakes and sort of malicious use of generative AI, as it can create very compelling and realistic facsimiles of either individual identities or corporate identities, which creates massive reputational risk and also challenges for governments as well. And so I think that's two examples of where the extension of legislation and how people are thinking about insights into how the models work and confidence in outputs are really, really a focus of where some of the jurisdictions are heading.
Yeah. No, I agree, right? And it really is an evolution, right? It's a fast evolution, and it's a very an evolution that will change a lot of things, but it is an evolution of the risk we've seen with a couple of twists, right? So the fairness aspect that we talked about, which has been a thing for any kind of analytical engine for a very long time. Historically, I'd say in most industries, a part of the solution has been creating real transparency about how a model works, right? So if you have a traditional, more traditional analytical model, you kind of open up and say whether you're regulated or not, you show and say, hey, we can explain exactly what happened. And that's part of the reason how we say you should get comfortable with the model. That is a very different game, right, with generative AI, because the explainability of these models is just, let's be honest, it's not quite there. And so while the risk might be the same, it'll be very interesting to see how different companies and how regulators, among others, are going to deal with getting comfortable overcoming, right, something that can't be opened up and dissected, but we've got to rely on other indicators to get comfortable with the fairness.
So are you seeing any common areas that governments and regulators are focusing on in terms of risks they're trying to protect their constituents against? And where is explainability falling into that mix?
I think you've picked up on the most important one, Sean, which is a deeper understanding. And it's again, a great question, a deeper understanding of how do these models work and how were they going to have confidence that the models are producing outcomes either that can be explained in some fashion, and to Ida's point, explainability is a foundational challenge with generative AI models. Also, sourcing. How have you know, a lot of discussion now about watermarks of generative AI. Can you actually tell when something's been AI generated versus generated by our traditional creative process? And that flows into IP challenges. I suspect, given the range of elections or the raft of elections that are coming up, there's going to be a lot of focus on those dynamics from the public sector. And it's also incredibly important to think about, you know, public trust in these systems and public willingness to use and engage them. And the only way that happens is if we have some combination of the different stakeholders at play, be that the LLMs, the companies who are developing the use cases, and then also the legislative branches and the people who are creating the frameworks in which we all operate.
And look, I think we will shock no one by saying that it's still early days for regulation, yeah. right? We expect much more to come, including sector-specific regulation for regulated industries, right? There's no doubt that financial services will face more specific regulation on top of this. So think about themes, right? I think it's the right way to do it. Trying to optimize for what's already out there will be a very short-lived strategy.
Thank you both. So in terms of the foundations on which these Gen AI models operate, those are the LLMs or large language models that you mentioned before. Can you talk a little bit about how decisions are made about what data goes into the models? And what is that interplay between the decisions on that data and some of the risk aspects that might emerge?
Yeah, so the early stages of the LLMs were basically trained on the internet. And so the information across the internet with, let's say, limited protection for IP. And so that's where you would have seen some of the significant IP considerations in terms of training them on works of literature or people's established IP. There's a much bigger awareness now that's a real potential challenge for how we want to engage with these models and the training sets. And so there are emerging practices in terms of, can you have fully licensed training sets? Can you have information that is owned by companies where they have the rights to train the LLMs? Websites are now putting deliberate flags to prevent people from training LLMs on their core data. And then the final thing I'll say, Sean, is one of the challenges the models face is that as more and more of the internet potentially gets produced by generative AI, the quality of training data is declining. And so as you train a generative AI model on an internet that is increasingly shaped and driven by generative AI outputs, seeing the research is strongly suggesting that performance actually degrades over time when you train it on Gen AI outputs. And so being very deliberate on how, if companies are choosing to adopt generative AI, which to Ida's point, we think is a strategic imperative, what's the data they want to train it on and how are they going to continue to refine it? It's an expensive and complicated process, but it is so worth the investment if you're serious about engaging and getting the most out of these models.
Thanks, Oliver. So are there any other considerations and emerging business practices that leaders should apply when they're working with these LLM providers?
We've covered some of this already, but the considerations are around how do you think about the use of reinforcement learning or human feedback to make sure that your model outputs are as effective and accurate as they can be and promoting sort of safe outputs there. Security controls and private repositories are increasingly important, especially as these companies think about commercialization and working with companies themselves. How do you create walled gardens or an appropriate infrastructure where the use cases are hived off and that it's not being fed back to the central training repository? Some of the AIs are experimenting with AI-driven supervision and self-improvement. So that's machines training machines. And so you think about constitutional AI, can you set up boundaries or guardrails in terms of how they act? And then can you use AIs to make sure or to test whether they're exceeding those boundaries? And then the final piece is just investing in their own risk and compliance teams. And as they think about identity and access management, the cybersecurity dimensions, privacy, and then also the ethics and how they think about using. And again, this gets back to the watermark question of how and where do they embed the signs that things have been generated by AI. These are all some of the things we're seeing the large LLMs do. But I suspect at this point it's going to continue to evolve and continue to adapt. And as you're thinking about, if you're a company thinking about engaging with the LLMs, really understanding what are the controls they have in place and what protections do they have that relates to how you want to use generative AI is central to your buying decision and how you want to engage with them.
And at the same time, clearly this is going to be one aspect, smaller aspect in managing risk overall. So when we survey executives, and we're McKinsey, we love to survey executives, early and often, really what the conclusions we get consistently is great awareness, a lot of exposure, right? We have some other surveys that show 22% of people we survey already use Gen AI in some version in the job. 80% have had some exposure to it that work at home. But the thing that really stood out to us is the surveys that show, 86% do not have a responsible AI program. 91% do not feel very prepared to deal with this. So in many ways, you can say clearly we are having a disconnect between the needs and then the maturity of these programs.
Great. Thank you, Ida. So for those companies that have been at this for the longest, What are some of the principles they're following to make sure that they continue to use Gen AI safely?
So those are things like, you don't let the machines run wild on their own. There's always a human aspect involved in that. You use the outcome of the models as an input to human decisioning, not as the final decision for many of these use cases. You continue to focus on fairness, as we talked about, right? And there's a bit of a flip here from focusing on how do we show the inner workings of the model to having to rely much more on tests after the fact, right? How can we prove that the outcomes of the models are not unfair, right? And it moves from the burden of evidence from the model itself to the outcomes and testing around the outcomes. The good news is Gen AI makes it a lot easier to do a lot of rapid tests to test the fairness, right? So again, Gen AI can be a real source for good also for some of the risk management capabilities in place. I'd say the two I'd highlight as being maybe the biggest step change from the responsible AI programs that most organizations have already been working on is this transparency and explainability that we touched upon already. And then the monitoring and evaluation, right? It's a different beast to keep an eye on this over time. And therefore we're seeing clients we work with very much invest in these areas and say, okay, what are the extra bells and whistles and checks we can put in place to get comfortable with what comes out?
Awesome. So we've talked about explainability, fairness, IP infringement, and a couple of others. Are there any other risks out there that we want to talk about? And how should companies think about sort of gauging the full gamut of risks that can emerge with Gen AI?
So let me touch upon a couple of these that we haven't. The data privacy aspects and the quality, again, there's some real decisions that we see organizations make about what you rely on. Oliver's example about, you know, don't create a death loop of training it on data that might already not be high quality. One of the things we do in McKinsey, for instance, we have created a network of all our proprietary knowledge and created that as the training data for some of our applications, right? Which means we control the quality of the data that comes in, which gives us a great deal of comfortability. Malicious use has been one of the, I'd say, more of the headline grabbing, right, between the deep fakes, all the examples that are out there. And it is pretty telling, right? And so, for instance, create an email asking your uncle to wire you $1,000 tomorrow. The ability, you know, you can write those emails, you can translate them to every language. And I think we've all, a little bit in our kind of personal risk awareness, gotten used to the vast amount of spam emails we get that tend to be telltale sign, right? Bad grammar, bad language, some things that just don't quite make sense. It is so much easier creating high quality spam emails using Gen AI. And so there's really a shift in the quality of some of the phishing aspects that will come out. And that requires, as I said, both some change in controls, but also a bit of a mindset change in terms of how we've been wired to how do you spot suspicious emails. Security threats is another one where Gen AI is really just multiplying the ability to break into systems. Some of the research I saw showed that Gen AI will improve the success rate of breaking passwords by somewhere between 50 and 70%. Gen AI also helps multiply cyber attacks, copying successful attack strategies much faster and replicating in a short amount of time. So I'd say most of the clients we talk to, this is really on top of their list of how do you enhance your cyber defenses, given the attack patterns that are starting to show up. And then let me talk finally a bit about strategic risk and third-party risk, which are other areas where we're really seeing a lot of emphasis, right? And strategic risk has aspects that span from, as we talked about, kind of the strategic risk from not doing so, the strategic risk involved with choosing your use cases, where do you play, how do you competitively place yourself. But it also has all the aspects of the broader societal impacts, right? So we all know Gen AI uses quite a lot of computational power. How does that match up with your ESG commitments? There's broader employment effects as well. What does it do to the workforce? How do you think about your commitments to your employees and the shifts that will bring? As we mentioned, it's a technology that's going to shift jobs very, very dramatically. And as companies work through how to do that, how to care for the employees, those are real questions to grapple with. And then finally, two aspects of third-party risk, right? One is Yeah, we're all just getting the LLPs, the large language providers, as a very significant third party. So how do you think about that? How do you think about getting comfortable with everything they're doing, including some of the things Oliver talked about in terms of how they are setting up their own risk and control systems? And then there's a third party aspect that also relates to, you know, your use of other third parties, right? And how are third parties affected by Gen AI risk, and how are they using Gen AI?
So you mentioned the importance of ensuring that the source material Gen AI uses is trustworthy. Have you seen anything in terms of data classification, governance, management that works really well, or any examples that maybe you could share?
Yeah, I can give a couple of examples. I think this is the place where thinking about what you want to get from generative AI and how you calibrate your use case is incredibly important. If you want to use generative AI as a tool for your employees to be more productive in terms of getting answers to general questions, then that's probably less critical in terms of thinking about the data fidelity, and you can get a lot from employee feedback. If your models are spitting out answers that don't make sense to your employees, or they feel like they are getting random things, they can provide feedback. But and that can be as simple as a thumbs up, thumbs down. It can be a little bit more engaging in terms of specific text, but that's a really important marker of sort of data quality and data quality controls. We had a very specific use case in terms of what we wanted our generative AI bot to do. We run a lot of data quality checks to make sure that we're feeding it the highest quality. And we have continued monitoring of, again, the responses and our ability to use those responses on the back end. There are places where there's a difference between, you're thinking about, are you using it for coding versus are you using it for marketing, and how you think through that. There's obviously differences in terms of how you think about the training data for text-based versus image-based. Thinking about how do you go from the idea of what you want your use case to be to technical implementation, including the specifics of data. And as you're doing the data, how do you adhere to what your organization views as good practice in data privacy and data protection for the training as well? So it's sort of a multifaceted aspect of answering this. And I don't think there's a set answer is the honest place that I've landed when we've been talking through this with clients.
But we would encourage, right, folks to say, to think about a tiering of use cases, the risk associated with the reliance and good quality, and then have a tiered approach to the quality, you know, requirements for the data. But as the use cases get more and more sensitive, you know, really increase the data quality considerations and requirements before something is allowed into the pool.
Got it. So now, if I understand correctly, what you put into your queries can also feed the model. So how does a company monitor what employees are feeding these models through their queries?
Yeah, it's potentially pretty scary, right? Because any prompt that is entered into this becomes part of that body of data as well, right? And so I would say, you know, most companies should be pretty worried about what their employees are doing. It's you know, we'll talk a bit about the guardrails you should put in place, but having a real clarity around what your employees are allowed to use this for. And by the way, it comes to the education point as well, right? Which is, you gotta educate your employees. You can't, you know, just rely on rules. You gotta make sure your employees understand what is the consequence of any prompt they put into a system.
Thanks, Ida. So let's talk a little bit more about what the risk management model or approach should look like to cover all of these risks. How are you advising clients on this? Maybe Oliver, you could take a stab at that one.
We've basically got four categories. One is on the principles and guardrails. The second is on frameworks. Third is on deployment and governance. And then fourth is on risk mitigation and monitoring. On the principles and guardrails, we do think it's incredibly important to have an honest conversation as an executive team about how and where you want to use generative AI as you're thinking about segmenting your use cases. Some examples that come up typically are considerations of the degree to which you want to use generative AI to personalize your marketing, for example, the extent to which you want generative AI to be used in performance evaluations or directly engaging with your employees, and questions around where and how would you be willing to put generative AI directly into production. So if you're thinking about support for coding, are you always going to have humans intermediating the generative AI outputs with production? Or are there places where you have sufficient maturity and confidence that you'd be willing to put it into production? And what are the kinds of cases that would be hallmarks of where you can get that confidence? On the frameworks, Ida's already talked about the taxonomy, so I won't go into that except to note that there are different flavors of the risks from generative AI and different ways of thinking about them. And just having something that works for your organization is incredibly valuable because it'll help you communicate to your employees how they should be thinking about this. On the risk identification, basically, you have to have a handle on what the types of risks you're going to face are. Are they developing? Are your exposures shifting and changing over time? That should be driven through your risk identification process. As we talk about deployment and governance, thinking about segmenting of use cases. So typically what a lot of our clients are doing is starting with lower risk, easier implementation risk use cases. That allows them the time to experiment with the governance standards they've put up. It allows them time to run the use cases through something like a risk assessment to understand the typical types of risks that they're exposed to from the use cases. And it also allows them to think through what's the type of escalations or what are the types of informational pathways you need to establish if things are starting to go wrong. As you get comfort with that, scaling both the number and the potential risk exposure from the use cases is something a lot of our clients do. When they're comfortable with the governance, when they're comfortable with the setup, they can go with much more ambitious things, which typically have significantly more business ROI and then potentially significantly more risk, and they need the comfort to manage those. Just given dynamics of generative AI and how it can, the models evolve over time, that they're dynamic. It's not as simple as just launching a pilot and scaling the pilot directly. The models are going to evolve as you scale them. You need to keep track of, are you seeing drift in terms of performance? Is that drift driven by concerns around the data fidelity as you're scaling it? Is it driven by shifts in capabilities with the models themselves? Is it driven by how your employees are engaging with it as they get more comfortable and they're experimenting more? And so just understanding how to manage that is integral to successful scaling of these models and getting the most out of them.
Thanks, Oliver. So now let's turn to how companies should approach mitigation of the external risks of Gen AI, including what kind of measures they are putting in place to protect against security threats that Gen AI could present.
The answer here is really a mix of tried and tested risk management techniques, building on what already exists, potentially turbocharging a few of them, and then adding a few more tools to the tricks, right? So when it comes to security threats, there's a lot of things we know about good cyber hygiene, about good cyber education capabilities, right? Both in the core cyber team and in users more generally, right? Education about phishing, et cetera. But there's also, we believe, you know, a real need here to make sure that education goes broader, right? That you make sure that employees truly understand risk 101 of Gen AI, to be able to be alert, to be able to identify and spot when things are happening. So a broader sense of education, a broader sense of kind of getting people under the tent. And then there'll be, security is an area where we truly believe you got to fight Gen AI with Gen AI. And so most organizations now are really working through and saying, how do we use Gen AI tools to turbocharge our cyber defense, right? Turbocharge the way we do pen testing, the way we think about the different layers of our security, and make sure that our time to detection is way faster, right? Perimeter of keeping up with the time to detection is faster, and the time from detection to kind of shutting things down is faster, and that will be super super critical. Similarly, as you think about something like third-party risk, you would want to say, look, we have certain things that are in place, but we might need to opt our due diligence and really have other parameters that is in that. And then one of the things that we think is super interesting as well, if this is an area where the risk can be so high that you want to think fundamentally about redesigning processes. We talked recently with a financial services company that operates globally and relies on a kind of localized third-party network to authenticate their customers in different countries. Part of that is a facial recognition, right? That might not be the way to do this going forward. And so there might be, you know, simply your in your KYC processes, in your customer interactions, there might be a need to fundamentally rethink some of the ways you're doing this, right? Both in your third party usage, but also in the process you have internally, and say, hey, right, where are the places that malicious use could fundamentally undermine some of the security checks we have in place today? And how do we either fully change those processes or supplement them with additional checks to make sure that they are actually still doing what they're supposed to do?
Ida, you mentioned earlier that one can actually use GenAI to protect against GenAI threats. But how could one use GenAI to find deepfakes, for example? Or, one could envision an email that looks and reads just like it's coming from the CEO that's directing an employee to take certain steps. How do you use GenAI to actually mitigate that risk?
No, Sean, I mean, this is a very real question, and a very good question, right? And not an easy question. And as will be the case for a lot of these risks, there's not silver bullet, right? But what companies are doing is thinking about a triangulation of different things. Some of it will be process changes, right? As I mentioned, you might say, hey, we were used to, you know, if an ask comes through an email, you just go do it, no longer, right? If there's a voicemail left for you, you know, company policy is you will never, you know, act on that voicemail unless you call someone back and you get verification. So there's kind of controls and oversight you could put in place. But, and this is a big theme of what we're talking about today, it'll never be enough. Let's be honest, right? And it always has to go hand in hand with this awareness of our employees. And you gotta make sure that you have folks that says, that's a little weird. Like, that guy never leaves me a voicemail, right? And you kind of got to get that instinct up. And I was reminded, so I'm going to share a personal story with that. I think have a professional implication. I was, as many of us, it's been back to school last week, and I was attending a parent orientation for my oldest kid's high school. So, you know, a junior in high school. And there was an absolutely wonderful gentleman that leads technology for this high school, who after the parents had been like, you know, absolutely pummeling him with like 800 questions about the cell phone policy and, you know, and social media bullying, and it never ended. He said very, very accurately, he said, look, we can make rules out of our gazoo and we can do that all night long. It will never be enough. But what I'm here to do is to help educate your kids to make sure that they become good users of all the technology that exists in the world. And so first of all, that as a mom, that warmed my heart. But if I draw the linkage to what we're talking about here, I think, you know, what we are trying to teach our kids at all ages is exactly the same as what we need to teach our employees in this stuff, right? Which is we simply need to be students of the risk. And risk management, I've said this for many years, but it has never been more true before. Risk management is everyone's job. Right. And so there is a bit of an education and culture shift in some organizations to really make sure that gets embedded in the fabric and the culture of how we work together.
That makes a lot of sense, Ida. Thank you. And are there any other internal risks that companies should be aware of that maybe we haven't discussed yet?
One is just whatever Office productivity suite you use internally, there are going to be offerings that embed generative AI in there. They will help you take notes on your video conferences. They will help you synthesize PowerPoints. They will help you do write letters, or whatever it is that you need your employees to do. These features come with deliberate decisions on you of which third parties you are going to trust, which of the LLMs are you going to want to engage with as you think about your Office productivity software, and how are you going to train your employees to get the most out of them? And that's both employee awareness, if it feels like the answers they're getting are strange or unexpected as they're engaging with it, including things that seem made up. And part of the challenge with generative AI is the models will be very confident in asserting the right answer, even when they're wrong. And so helping your employees not take what comes back from their machines as gospel truth or as the what they should do is an incredibly important learning journey for many people. And also just an awareness that they have the responsibility for owning their Word product. And so they cannot just say, generative AI told me to do this and that's good enough. It's that accountability, that awareness that it is a tool, it is not a replacement, is an incredible lesson and part of core training that we train at that, both internally at our firm in terms of when we deploy generative AI and what we help our clients navigate. The second is on the use cases and just how do you think about managing risks as you experiment and scale your internal use of generative AI beyond the embedded features. Typically, there's multiple factors that drive how these risks manifest. One is just selection of use cases. So which use cases have you chosen? Have you chosen a good portfolio of use cases that balance your ability to get the most from them in terms of business value with awareness of the types of risks that you are seeing? Have you thought about the setup of the use cases? And then have you thought about what are the specific dynamics of risk from the use case itself? Have you done the risk assessment and walked through with this cross-functional team to understand, is it primarily a data privacy risk? Is it around IP infringement? Is it malicious use? Is it potential strategic risk in terms of employment considerations that are going to create a lot of nervousness with your employees?
Great. Thank you, Oliver. And what are the typical practices and maybe pitfalls that you see companies adopt as they scale their use cases and deployment of Gen AI internally?
Reliance on a small group of experts. Obviously, at the start, when you're building use cases, you will have potentially limited capabilities internally. You'll also have a group of acolytes or very excited people who want to spend a lot of their time working on generative AI. That small group of experts is going to rapidly get overwhelmed as you scale generative AI. It's going to create a lot of friction, a lot of frustration, and it's going to slow everything down. And unless you expand rapidly beyond that, you are going to always be gated in terms of your adoption potential. Relying solely on vendors also is not something we'd recommend. Frankly, even at the early stages, we've talked about how there's variations in terms of what the large language model providers and the other third-party ecosystems are doing. You need to take responsibility for diligence on generative AI, and you need to think about what you can do internally beyond just what they offer as out-of-the-box security solutions. Similarly, just having technical mitigation strategies is typically not going to be sufficient, and that's going to be driven by, to Ida's point, the compute costs. Technical mitigation strategies can get very expensive in terms of scaling up, and so thinking about how you deploy them sensibly and responsibly. We're still learning a lot about how the different controls and mitigations perform. And so you need some overlay of human factors, including things like human in the loop, i.e. not putting things directly into production without some human validation or confirmation that it's doing what it's intended to do. The fourth one is very attractive as you start and including as you scale, which is you have your separate risk group and you have your separate development group. And they really don't talk very often until it gets to the end. And then the risk group comes in and says, wait, what are you doing? And no, you can't launch this. And so you want to have it integrated as soon as you can. And then just given the evolution and dynamics of generative AI, being aware that these will evolve and change over time and that you need to have ways to track that evolution is integral for successful and sustainable scaling.
Thanks very much. This is all really fascinating and interesting. And I'm sure it can also be a bit intimidating, especially to those just starting out with new use cases in Gen AI. Since this is something that all employees are likely going to need guidance and counsel on in an organization, what are some of the most common roles you're seeing companies either have or create to help with that?
I mentioned before, everyone is a risk manager. Everyone needs to be a risk manager. So as we think about everyone from the person who thinks about the exciting use cases for Gen AI, the person who builds that into real systems, the actual honest-to-God risk manager, and then the users, every single of one of these personas, if you will, or groups in your organization has an incredibly important role to play when it comes to risk management. And so our encouragement to all of you is, as you think about building out the roadmap and the strategy, don't forget the people aspect and don't forget really clarifying the expectations for each of these. I talked a bit already about the user, right? The awareness, the kind of spidey sense for things that look strange. For the vision design and the capability builders, the big idea here is to say, you got to shift left. And what I mean by shifting left is to say, you got to embed risk considerations not after the fact as a, oh, how do we manage the risk that just happened to come along as we pursue these use cases? But it has to be a critical aspect of how you choose the use cases, how you select implementation speed, and the specific features of how you roll it out. It means that this is a constant dialogue. It's upskilling the risk capabilities of the folks that are working on the ideas, just as it is upskilling the Gen AI and the technology capabilities of the risk managers to make this come together, and really make sure that for each of these roles, there's a very well defined responsibility as it comes to risk management.
Awesome. So, any final thoughts on risk mitigation that you want to emphasize for our listeners?
The final one I'll highlight is just this adversarial testing, which is incredibly important as you are scaling the use cases. The red teaming of these models, having a crack team who's going in to try and break them and see where are the failure modes, what are the patterns where they are giving you flawed, inconsistent, incorrect, biased, problematic responses. That red team, that adversarial testing will help you really get into the dynamics of how to calibrate those generative AI models. And you need them to continue that testing over time. Just doing that at the start is not going to be sufficient because these models will adapt, they will change. And so you want to be running adversarial testing on a fairly decent frequency, especially as you're looking to scale these beyond an initial MVP.
Great. Let me end on the three elements that we basically advise all our clients to think through as they are building responsible AI capabilities. The first aspect is really around understanding your risk, right? Update your emerging risk identification process. Number two is the guardrails, the governance, including the people roles we talked about. And number three is about really embedding the risk considerations shift left in every use case and every aspect of your transformation.
Thank you both. Could each of you just briefly share what you're most excited about from a positive perspective? How, for example, does responsible Gen AI unleash organizations to really be able to take advantage of this new technology? Ida, maybe you could go first.
Yeah, no, thanks for that question. And if in our discussion of risk, it came across as a doomsday, you know, we do apologize. This is very much in my mind, this classic building better breaks to go faster. And this is what it is, right? I'm actually incredibly excited as well about this idea of shifting left is something we talked about for many years. And it's been hard to implement. I think we're now having enough value at stake that we will begin to see a more seamless, you know, working together in an agile way between risk and develops of Gen AI. And so, yes, we'll unleash all this potential from the technology, but I think hopefully also, you know, really, really get it right in terms of working together and embedding risk much, much earlier, which would make an old practitioner as me very, very happy.
Thank you, Ida. Oliver, any final thoughts from you?
I think that the thing that I'm most excited about is just bringing ethics back into how we think about risk management and deployment of this. Where do we want to take this amazing technology? How do we want to use it safely? How do we want to use it in a way that most benefits our employees, our clients, and the broader society? And I think those are conversations we really, really need to start having. And the fact that we can make that specific to each organization's strategy and what role they want to play in the broader ecosystem is, to my mind, one of the most exciting things that's coming out of this generation. AI piece and core to doing it responsibly as well.
Thank you so much, Ida, Oliver. This has been a really interesting conversation and really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. We'll include a link to the article that I mentioned at the beginning of the episode in the show notes so you can explore all of Oliver and Ida's recommendations in more detail. And if you'd like to share feedback or an idea for a future podcast, we encourage you to email us at itsr@mckinsey.com. And that stands for Inside the Strategy Room. You can also share your ratings and reviews on your favorite podcast player with many thanks to everyone who's already done so. We really appreciate all of your comments and feedback and encourage you to keep them coming. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to subscribe, you can easily follow our weekly series on your favorite podcast player, where you can also access our entire library of previous episodes. We also offer an Inside the Strategy Room podcast collection page available at mckinsey.com/ITSR. And there you can easily browse our prior podcasts across 6 major themes and access written transcripts of all of those conversations. Finally, if you'd like to receive alerts on Aliyah's publications and insights, we encourage you to sign up on our insights page at mckinsey.com/scf or connect with us on LinkedIn at the McKinsey Strategy and Corporate Finance Practice page. Thanks again for listening. We look forward to having you join us again next week inside the Strategy Room.